Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday, the 18th of February. Very nice to have you with us. And we appreciate you being here. As always, we had the day off yesterday. It was a federal holiday. Some people didn't have to work. We were included in that. We got a letter or two from people saying, why aren't you doing a show? And we wrote back and said, it's a federal holiday and we're resting. And clearly there's nothing going on in the world. So it's but it's good to be back. And thank you very much for if you were putting up with our absence, thank you. If you were enjoying the peace and quiet, I apologize. We're back. Good morning. We have a great group this morning. A lot to talk about, a lot to catch up on, and we'll get started right away. I just want to quickly bring you up to date on the 14th of Valentine's Day. That was a Friday. On the 14th of February was the last time we spoke on this program. And I just wanted to give you just a little idea. I did this last week. I'd like to do this week of what has happened since our show ended on Friday in the new administration and things that were going on. This is all the stuff. This is not all the stuff. This is a partial list. But here we go. Announced tariffs on foreign cars beginning on April 2nd. Established an national emergency dominance council to promote American energy sources and jobs. Strength funds for navigators who help Americans enroll in Obamacare health insurance plans. Scolded European leaders for failing to uphold democratic values, and tacitly voiced approval of European far-right parties, alluding to support for Germany's far-right party ahead of elections in the nation. You may notice that some of these are more worrisome than the others. Accelerated plans for widespread workforce cuts across multiple federal agencies. Appended disclaimer disavowing gender ideology to all Centers for Disease Control and Prevention web pages that mention gender identity. Toughened security requirements for sponsors of migrant children. Asked a federal judge to drop charges against New York Mayor Eric Adams. Fired, then unfired federal employees responsible for the readiness of America's nuclear arsenal. Fired 18 immigration judges, discussed plans to rip up the White House Rose Garden to replace it with a cemented patio. That was just on Friday. Then we go to Saturday, ordered federal funding to be withheld from schools that required COVID vaccinations. Appointed 6 new special assistants to the president in the White House Office of Legislative Affairs. Announced on social media, he who saves his country does not violate any law. Asked the Supreme Court to vacate a lower court's order that temporarily reinstated the head of the Office of Special Counsel, and did a partial lap of the Daytona 500 in the presidential limousine. He was the pace car at Daytona in the Beast. Partial list. But there's a lot there, a lot to talk about. As I mentioned last week, we can't do it all, but we're going to certainly try and to get to the big stuff that's been happening and talk about and try to bring as many of these in to each other as possible. We have a great group to do this morning. Senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, James Ketterer, is here. Hello, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing well. Good morning. I am just back from a trip to Des Moines, and the good people of Iowa hosted me really nicely at the Harkin Institute, and enjoyed the trip. It wasn't exactly tropical weather there, but it's not really here either, so glad to be here, though.
Were they going to? Are they going to give up that caucus nonsense, or no? Are they still? Did you get a sense of that?
I didn't get a sense about the caucus. There was a lot of talk about. I was out there talking about jazz diplomacy, so a little different than the caucus. But enjoyed the trip very much. It's a really interesting city.
Bob Bellafiore is with us, communications expert and founder and president of Stanhope Partners. Bob, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Well, so far so good. I read today a new Gallup poll of 75,000 people in 52 countries that says what people want most from their leaders is hope. 56%, 33% trust, 7% compassion, 4% stability. And I thought that was timely because while it's not spring weather, it is spring training. And if anything, Right? We talk a lot about politics here, and politics is either hope or despair, and the country's probably 50-50. Yes. But spring training is all about hope. And, right, as Andy Dufresne said in Shawshank Redemption, hope is the most important thing. It may be the only thing. So it's 0 degrees out with the wind chill, and I'm sitting here hopeful for baseball.
Play ball.
Yeah, I think next, is it next Friday or Saturday is the first exhibition game, and which is great in the cactus and grapefruit leagues of Florida and Arizona. And then, I'm off the first week in March to go down and follow my Philadelphia Phillies for a week. So we'll see how that goes. Looking forward to it. All right. We also are blessed to have the mayor of the city of Albany, Kathy Sheehan, with us. Always a pleasure to welcome the mayor to the program, and I thank you very much for taking the time out of your day to do this.
Thank you for having me. I did not rest yesterday because I was babysitting my almost 3-year-old granddaughter,
who's
delightful but busy. And I want to encourage everyone to get out there and please find a way to melt the ice, shovel your sidewalks. It's treacherous out there, and it's not going to get any warmer for a while. So we don't want to fine you, but we do need to get sidewalks cleared. And I'm going to set off a firestorm of letters because, you know, you didn't mention that Bob is sitting here in a Mets jersey. So
I'm
sure people will have views
on
that.
I kind of blocked it out, I think. I didn't see it. I don't notice those colors in my retina.
It was really, I'm just sucking up to Ray Graff. Yeah. Who, the last time I was here, it was a lockbox day, and he was wearing a Mets jersey. And
that's
I said,
right.
Okay, this is allowed.
It's allowed. Yeah. Certainly allowed.
Now Joe, I think your listeners ought to know that when you put Jim and Kathy and me together and combine all the years that we know each other, right, in sort of triangulate. I mean, Kathy and I have known each other for like 34 years, right? Jim and I have known each other almost as long. He made the joke that I was his overseer when I was a SUNY trustee and he was a vice chancellor. And if anybody who knows anything about SUNY governance, it's not sure who's in charge of who over there. and Jim and Kathy know each other from grammar school. Being parents in the same grammar school. So this is, and yet we have never assembled to have this kind of moderated, if not immoderate, conversation.
That's what we try to do here at the Roundtable, to bring these disparate factions together for a knee-deep conversation on the issues.
And then Joe has to manage it all. So good luck.
You know, good luck.
That's fine. And during all that time, for 30 years, I've just been sitting here. So I'm glad you finally all came to.
Well, I see the chair, premises. But no whip. You have a chair, but no whip.
No,
so
no,
I'm not sure how you're going to do
that
this.
Don't need that here. Well, good morning, all. Welcome to the program, and there's a lot going on, as we said, and this is one of those things where you write the stories that I send out stories usually the night before, and then like moments later they become outdated in some way, shape, or form, and so that was kind of the case of what I did last night, but we have stories to talk about. I would like to begin with the New York City drama, where the New York City mayor continues to be under fire, and this is this, of course, you know the story where the president and it was the Justice Department, we assume under the direction of the president, to order the Justice Department to drop charges, have prosecutors drop charges against Mayor Adams. Now there's just been this cascade of resignations and a lot of backlash as a result of that. When last we spoke on Friday, we had a discussion about, well, would the governor get involved? And we basically said, well, probably not, because there's a lot of reasons that could be detrimental for her. But now, with this whole new slew of top aides, four top aides resigning, again, the calls for Eric Adams to step down as the mayor of the city of New York are growing louder and louder. Now, Governor Kathy Hochul has raised the prospect of removing Adams from office and has said that she will be meeting with New York City leaders to discuss, quote, a path forward for the governor. And it's as if the mayor was in crisis before, and then four key deputy mayors say, okay, we're leaving, and then Mayor Adams once again is plunged again into crisis. Earlier in the day yesterday, while speaking at speaking at a church in Brooklyn, said, I'm not going anywhere. He continues to soldier on, and is getting ready to hire well-regarded replacements and working both in the interest of the city and that of helping President Trump when it comes to the issue of immigration. So there's a lot there to discuss. But what from one mayor to another, let me ask Mayor Sheehan of what you make of Mayor Adams and where this, in your opinion, should be where we should be now and where it should what direction it should go in.
Well, I mean, it certainly raises questions, I think, in people's minds about are we focused on actually the work of running a city, or is this just too much of a distraction from day-to-day operations? So I can understand people's concerns, and I think that the governor's in a very difficult position. I think to say that she's raised the specter of removing him, I think she's been called upon
Correct.
By many people, and they're asking why hasn't she removed him? And I think, again, you know, her point that in the 235 years that this power has existed, it's never been exercised, it certainly would give one pause, especially given that this is a duly elected citywide official. And it's a very, very difficult position to put the governor in. And I wish her all the best in trying to navigate through it. But I think, you know, I have a friend who was visiting who lives in New York City. And I think that the issue that she raises is how are the things that we really need to focus on actually moving forward, notwithstanding what the mayor says, when this is all swirling around and people are legitimately concerned about the city and its future and what the changes that are happening in Washington are going to have on impacting the economic health and other issues in the city.
From those from the outside looking in, from your perspective, and I mean, without getting into the personalities involved, but from your perspective, I mean, if like all your top aides quit, like there's a problem, right? For us looking on the inside, oh, there's something going on here.
I certainly would be incredibly concerned if that were to happen under my leadership. And I think these offices are about more than us.
Yes.
We've had a mayor for, you know, many years in the city. This is a city that's over 300 years old. So, you know, we've had mayors, and it's about the office of mayor. It's not about the person. And I think when the person becomes a distraction, it's very difficult to justify not having some sort of introspection about what's best for the city and what's best for the residents of the city.
Bob?
Well, it's I'm not sure we have any other time to. This has so many layers to it. The mayor raises a handful of really good points, one of which is Mayor Adams was duly elected. A governor has never done this. Important to say, this is a temporary measure. It's not like she can remove the mayor and then he's gone forever, like she can send him to Elba, right? It's a 60 or 90 day. It's basically a suspension where the public advocate then takes over, and then it kicks off a process. But it's not, you know, it's not like the tooth gets pulled.
Right.
It just means they're going to put some Ambisol on the toothache for a while.
During an election season.
Well, sure. Yeah. Right. And in many ways, could turn Eric Adams into a victim. So that's one thing. Mayor also raises a really good point about what is it that the people of New York really care about? the politicians all care about this, and I can see Democratic politicians wanting him out because they don't want to have to defend him, right? Or they don't want to have to live with him. He's like a sore on their body politic, and they just as soon get rid of it and not have to worry about it. What do the people in New York City really care about? Does garbage get picked up? Are the cops on the street? Does a subway? Can I get my subway? Can I get my bus? This is a more of a distraction for them. I will sort of make two other points real quick. There were knives out, but when Eric Adams was simply indicted for being a Turkish puppet, there was not this rush to kick him out of Gracie Mansion. But now that they see him as a Trump puppet, he's got to go. And for me, I'm wondering, well, what is this really about? While he is pledging to work with the president on a thing that New York City residents deeply care about, which is illegal immigration and migrants coming here, Venezuelan gangs causing mayhem in the city.
To be fair, I take your point, but immediately following all of the initial charges, there were a raft of resignations from within the Adams administration, and there were calls for him to for a resignation, in which at that time the governor demurred, and I think for all the reasons we're talking about now, said, you know, let's wait it out and see what happens.
Oh yeah, well I said the knives are out,
but yes. I think that the thing about him courting the Trump administration is the next step. It's the quid pro quo of
right.
Now using the Justice Department to say, drop the charges. And that is what I think starts the beginning of the end of our democracy. And it's a level of corruption that I think is what people are reacting to, because whether it's true or not, it's perceived as this is how we move forward. When you curry favor, then if you've done something wrong, we're going to look the other way as long as you do what I say. Those charges aren't permanently dropped, right? They're still hanging over him and
well,
can be reinstated.
Right.
But that's the piece of it, right? That's the piece of it. It's not, you know, look, I think all of us as mayors and as elected officials at the local level and at the state level are all looking at this Trump administration and saying, what do we need to do to ensure that we are able to advocate for our residents, have access to resources? So I think that's happening no matter what. It's the quid pro quo that I think people are definitely, well, it's what people are responding to.
Can I just add one thing that
yeah,
is a
we're
general?
We're going to put off a break for a few minutes because I want to hear from you. I want to hear from Jim, and then we'll go to a break after that.
The mayor makes really good points. I just want to focus on a dependent clause, which is really important these days, whether it is true or not. Now, truth matters, right? And what is so is more important in the long run than the perception. Politicians deal with the perception because this is what people seem to think at the moment and how they're going to react in that world. So I just want to say that about grammar. The second thing is I followed Eric Adams for a long time. I know people who worked with him very closely in the police department. He has always had kind of the aroma of a huckster, right?
That was your first jazz album, wasn't it, Jim?
Yeah,
Aroma of a Huckster.
Yeah, it was a big seller.
Yeah. when he was at the NYPD and when he was in the legislature, there's always been this sort of thing, right? So for the DOJ and the White House, to the extent it's involved, to sort of cozy up to this, I mean, it's like two aromas meeting in the middle.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that's a real smart move by the administration, because everything sort of Adams gets involved with gets a little
weird. Murky.
Yeah, a little murky.
Jim,
Well, you know, I normally deal with things like the Middle East and the Balkans, and they're much easier to navigate than New York State and New York City politics. and I'm only half joking. And I do think, as both of my fellow panelists are saying, it's important to look at the overall atmospherics, and that matters in the political realm. But it's also important to look at the facts and to look at what we know. And in terms of the quid pro quo, we know that the person who's really overseeing for the administration the operations of the immigration roundups was on TV with Eric Adams sitting next to him. And he pretty much just said straight out this was a quid pro quo. And if Adams reneges on it, we're going to come find him. And we're going to reinstate these charges. He said it for all of us to see.
Said the quiet part out loud.
He said it. So we know that. It's not, you know, what's true and what's not true. You know, we also know that two very serious conservative prosecutors resigned over this. One of them, who has two Bronze Stars, served in combat, clerked for John Roberts, wrote a scathing resignation letter. The other one clerked for Scalia and resigned over this. I mean, these things we know actually happened. So this is more than where there's smoke, there might be fire. This is engaging in behavior from Washington, interceding in an actual criminal case where the mayor was charged not just with being a puppet of the Turks, but being corrupt. Receiving money from a foreign power for purposes of corruption. And how do we get to the truth? Well, we have an actual long-standing process that allows us to get to the truth, which is called the rule of law. And we should let the rule of law play out. If the mayor is in fact innocent, let him stand trial, let the evidence be shown, and let him be found innocent. If he's guilty, he's guilty. That's the process that we have that has worked really pretty well over centuries in this country. If we're going to undo that process and it's going to be just all politics all the time, that's a big problem. Now, in terms of the governor, you know, I used to live in the state of Maryland, and there's always a difficult relationship between the governor's office in Annapolis and the mayor's office in Baltimore. And it's the same in New York City. I mean, my two colleagues here know very well because they've lived it. But the political tensions between mayors and governors over the whole history of this state is you know, you could write many, many books on it. And there have been some good books written on it. And so the governor, I think that, you know, she has emerged as a really important voice from the Democratic Party in countering what's coming from Washington and from the Trump administration. And whether it's on the Louisiana case and the doctor and other things, this really does put her in a very, very dicey situation because it's the politics of it. It's the politics of the Democratic Party. It's national politics. It's state politics. It's city politics. But it is also, as Bob pointed out, it's also the rule of law. It's also democracy. I mean, the voting of people voted for Eric Adams. And to undo a vote, there's a reason this has never been done. That's very tough stuff. And I understand that the governor is meeting with a lot of people today, one-on-one, to talk about this issue. It's going to be fascinating. You know, I think really tough for the state, for the city, tough for democracy in general, but really fascinating to analyze.
And there's an election in 9 months.
Yeah, yeah. And the governor has an election coming up the year after that. And she needs to be a viable candidate in the city of New York.
Well, us Democrats would say there's an election in 4 months. So the primaries in June.
Well, that's democracy for you.
And it could be a hell of a primary.
Yes.
Oh, it's already shaping up to be one.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have letters, and we'll talk more about this subject. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, Mayor Kathy Sheehan, Jim Ketterer, and Bob Bellafiore here, and we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday morning, the 18th of February, 39 minutes past 9 o'clock. And we'll continue to talk about this issue of Mayor Adams, Eric Adams of New York City, and the decisions that the governor has before her. As we mentioned, she'll be holding a many meetings today to talk with various people and various officials to help in a decision as to whether she is going to call for or ask the governor to resign. I guess she removes him. She doesn't call for it, right? Is that the correct wording of that?
I believe so.
Yeah. Denise writes us and says, so we in New York City don't care if the mayor is corrupt. We just care about garbage and cops? Me thinks not. The only garbage that should be taken out is the quid pro quo mayor. Vote him out. That is Denise.
Vote him out. Now,
vote
that's
him
a different
out.
That's a different story than remove him.
Yes.
I mean, and that reverts to the people should cast their votes and vote him out. Yeah.
Go ahead.
And, you know, I made the joke about the primary, but if he loses the primary, which many people predict that he would remain in office until the end of the year. And
right.
I think that that is also an inflection point at which a decision could be made. But that is the conundrum that the governor is facing. Do you wait the 4 months and have him have the people decide, or do you make that decision ostensibly for them? Because even with the 60 days and the 90 days, you know, you're going to get to a point where the primary will have occurred.
Could he become a Republican candidate?
Well, certainly. You know, that we could do a whole show on those who have tried to get the Republican line and done some corrupt things to attempt to do that, or allegedly done some corrupt things to attempt to do that. But, you know, certainly he could.
And we haven't mentioned at all Carl McCall, Andrew Cuomo. I mean, there's a lot of other, I think, Bob, you alluded to it. There's many layers to this. There's a lot going on here beyond just the immediate decision.
Oh, yeah. The minute this door gets opened and you see who's in the other room, it's the 800-pound gorilla who hopes that everybody's memory has been erased, which is Andrew Cuomo.
We go to this letter from Garrett. We care about not having a mayor being blackmailed by the president of the United States to do his bidding. Our problems with undocumented immigrants is started by Texas and Florida, not by New York. One political misdeed does not justify another, says Garrett. We go to Henry chastising me for misquoting Mayor Adams. He did not say, I'm not going anywhere. He said, I assume with unintended irony, I'm going nowhere. That is true. That is what he said. And I apologize for my...
I don't know that the mayor should be dinged for brevity.
Tim says, why are Governor Hochul and other Democrats pushing to remove Eric Adams rather than allowing the Democratic process to play out in the upcoming election? He will lose. By taking such an aggressive stance, they will inadvertently create a martyr out of Adams and embolden MAGA. Have Democrats learned nothing from past experiences where such moves only strengthen their opponents? Why not play the long game and let the people decide in the election rather than repeating the same strategic missteps? Unless they see this as a path to undermine Cuomo's run, although I do not give them that much credit, unfortunately. I mean, correct me, anyone on the panel, correct me if I'm wrong here, but this seems like the governor is not jumping up and down to do this, right? I mean, this is the last thing she wants to be able to have to think about.
I have not interpreted her, what she has said on this thus far, as her pushing for it. I think she is receiving increased pressure to do something about this, and that is what she is responding to.
And could I also just note that Bob had already said this would make him a victim, and so maybe that letter writer wrote before Bob said it, or they're not listening closely.
Here's another sort of interesting political dynamic. If the governor does this, the city becomes her problem. And right now, while the city is a political subdivision of the state, and the city can't do anything, can do limited things on its own without state approval, she runs the risk of it becoming a problem that she has to manage all the time because she's the one who took Adams out. And it's not like the governor is on the firmest political ground. You know, when you look at public opinion polls, her numbers are still underwater. I'm going to presume they are worse in the city than that she is bolstered by upstate and worse in the city, although I haven't looked real closely in that. So it is. It does put her. She's, I mean, the mayor said it. She's in an awful spot, and she is walking around saying, take this cup from my hand. And no one's going to do it except her.
David writes to us and says, if Eric Adams is innocent as he has claimed, he should go to trial, accept the verdict, and then run for mayor of New York City and let the voters decide. The deal he has agreed to has to be the dumbest deal in the history of the city. Trump has his thumb in Mr. Adams for as long as DJT is alive.
Let me also just remind people, too, that there's a history of mayors in other cities even being convicted, in some cases going to jail and coming back and running and winning again. Washington, D.C., when
Marion
I was living Barry, there, Marion yeah. Barry, Providence, Rhode Island, mm-hmm. Buddy Cianci.
Bridgeport, yeah. Connecticut.
Yeah. So
official corruption while in office, he got reelected, still the mayor.
Yeah. So democracy, you know, you got to really want it. It keeps coming.
This is interesting, though. And when you look at leverage, right now, the politician, like the governor and the leaders in Albany, have an interesting leverage opportunity now on Adams. Because, right, so the president's holding something over his head. Now, the people who want him out could have something over his head and kind of put him into this, you know, between a rock and a hard place, torn between an elephant and a donkey, however you want to pull him, to put him in a real spot, right? Like how does he manage his way through this dilemma and to force him to just resign?
But think about this. I mean, we're spending all this time talking about a person. And I think that is really when we look at where politics are, you know, it is a politics of personality. And it's a politics that is much more focused, to me, on the individuals than on the sanctity of the office. And you look back at when Nixon resigned, you look back over history, and this is newer. There have always been, you know, cults of personality throughout history, but we're spending all of this time talking about this individual who clearly has reached, to me, a point where it's, I don't know what he talks about every day in his, how do you hold a staff meeting? Like this becomes
need a staff.
Overwhelming, yeah. Right? and so you've got your workers, the people who are actually running things who are walking away from this. And at some point, the house of cards falls.
So, and what does, and I'm sort of speaking in the abstract here, but what does he have to keep doing to keep whatever, if there is a quid pro quo or the deal or the conversation, how does he keep Trump happy during all of this?
I think Trump is very happy to see Governor Hochul squirm over this. And so that works for him politically. And I think he's happy to see continued, you know, chaos in the Democratic Party in New York State and in New York City. And Kathy, in terms of the Nixon case, that's a good example, because ultimately what convinced Nixon were people from his own party who came to him and said, it's over. You got to go. It wasn't what the Democrats were doing. It wasn't the hearings. It wasn't the investigations. It wasn't the Washington Post. It was his own party collapsing around him.
Oh, no. He knew that the votes for impeachment were in the House.
Yeah.
But
his party said to him.
But he wasn't convinced out of honor. He was convinced out of
politics.
He knew that he was going to. He knew that he was going to be impeached.
Right.
So it was the. It was the legal. It was the removal process. But not his, not the persuasion.
But my
process.
Point was just that there were people of his own party had the spine to come to him and said, "Mr. President,
well, sure,
you don't have the votes. You're not. It's not going to work." And you know, in this case, it would be Democrats coming to Adams saying the same. And you know, it seems like it's happening already.
So what does the mayor do? He focuses on the job. I mean, they have a lot of work to do. He focuses on the job. I think people will go work in City Hall because working at that level of government is a noble endeavor, and you have a chance to make things better. I mean, look at you cannot find somebody more capable or more ethical than Jessica Tisch, who ran the sanitation department, and then in the midst of all this, decided to take on the single hardest job in City Hall, which has become in charge of the police department.
Very tough.
Right, yeah. Right. Very tough. And, you know, frankly, she should be mayor.
But it's one thing to take that job because you want to protect the police department and the integrity of the police department. It's another thing for some of these other positions where it becomes a taint potentially on your resume. And if you are looking at wanting to have a career in public service, it can be very difficult to find good people.
All right. Let's move on to other subjects. We have a break in 10 minutes, but we can at least start the discussion and then break and come back. So then we'll move to U.S. and Russia pursuing a partnership in what the New York Times refers to as a head-spinning shift in relations. The two sides met in Saudi Arabia for their most extensive discussions in years. In addition to Ukraine, business ties were on the table. Meanwhile, Europe's leaders are dazed by an ally acting like an adversary and are looking to recalculate, faced with undisguised hostility from the Trump administration. Europeans are preparing for what is shaping up to be a go-it-alone era, apparently. President Trump's plan to negotiate a peace settlement in Ukraine with Vladimir Putin, with neither the Ukrainians nor Europeans invited to take part, has forced dazed leaders in capitals like Berlin, London, and Paris to confront a series of hard choices, painful trade-offs, and costly new burdens. Jim, where are we on this? This is a head scratcher for all.
Head scratcher is one way to put it. Yeah, it's I'm teaching a course this semester, a graduate seminar for Bard on diplomacy, and we just finished reading a book. It's actually a book by Henry Kissinger, his doctoral dissertation, and it looks at the end of the Napoleonic Wars and the negotiations that happened to kind of piece Europe back together and to stabilize it for a century. And but you know, to really dive into what the diplomatic efforts that went to stabilize it, we had to take a hard look at what was destabilizing. And my students, very smart, very good students, clearly see the parallels to our time. And we're in Europe, and many of them are European, we're in the midst of this period of destabilization and seeing destabilizing forces at work. What I think surprises many, including many in leadership positions in the United States and in Europe, I don't mean leadership in the White House, but other leadership positions, is to see that the United States is one of those destabilizing forces, apparently. And to begin to publicly state at the beginning of negotiations with Russia that we're going to take NATO membership for Ukraine off the table, and we're going to take territorial advances into Ukraine by Russia off the table. Well, those are the two big things. There's not a lot left to negotiate. Those are the two major issues. And I've spent time in Ukraine. I was there in 2014, right after the Maidan uprising and the change in government there. And I was there working with the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And I was back in Lviv in 2020. And when I was there, particularly in 2014, battles were raging in the Donbas, particularly in Donetsk. And I went to some funerals of Ukrainians who had been killed in those efforts. And I got a real sense of the depth and the passion of Ukrainian nationalism. And I can tell you, if we, the United States, by edict, just negotiate away large swaths of territory of Ukraine, we will set in motion a Ukrainian violent insurgency that will continue for decades coming. And that's one thing. Secondly, the viability of NATO, the rifts that have been created. I mean, that speech by J.D. Vance, I'm hearing from so many of my European friends who just said this is such a kind of preposterous speech to give this speech that not only is avoiding talking about the major issues, security issues that are on the table, but is wagging a finger and lecturing the Europeans, and then blowing off a meeting with the German chancellor and going meeting with the right-wing party. I mean, these all just not only send the wrong signal, they send a signal that I got a sense of when I was in Sweden a year and a half ago, and I was talking to a young officer from the Special Forces, and he said, we know we're not going to be able to count on the Americans. We're going to have to dig in ourselves. We live in a very dangerous part of the world in a very dangerous moment, and we're getting ready. And, you know, we're seeing really massive shifts in alliances, expectations, and assumptions that we just simply, I at least, don't have the imagination to have been able to see this coming, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. This is really a watershed moment.
And I think, you know, I was in Ukraine in June and sat with a woman from Mariupol who has no home to go back to. And they truly believed that America was going to be there for them. And even with the delays in aid and the politicization of it, I don't think that they ever thought that we would walk away and that we would do what is happening right now, where we're having peace negotiations without one of the countries who's in the one that is in the war at the table. And so I went to Ukraine with a number of people who had worked for the first Trump administration, worked for USAID, ironically, thought that they were going to be going back to jobs at USAID when Trump won again, were supportive of him and believed that he would stand with Ukraine. You know, those of us who were on the trip who were supporting the other side didn't see it and thought that was very short-sighted and you weren't listening to Trump if that's what you thought was going to happen. But, you know, we're becoming colonizers again. I mean, that's to me what I see. I don't know what you think of that, but when you look at what he's saying about Gaza and what he's saying about Ukraine and, you know,
Canada,
Greenland, this is about you know, revisiting a history of the United States and others saying we're going to divvy up the world and this is how it's going to go.
Can I just jump in? I'm sorry, Bob.
No, that's good.
To just jump on in this too, because I just want to mention one other thing, though, Kathy, about the United States and Ukraine. That you know, I agree with you. They thought that we would be with them. They hoped that they would be with them. But we have a checkered past. And this is it's not just a Trump checkered past. When I was there on the ground in 2014, Russia had already taken back Crimea, depending on how you view that history. And we had signed in the 1990s, the Brits, I think the Chinese, the Russians, and the Ukrainians, something called the Budapest Memorandum, that said Ukrainian territory would be defended in return for them giving up the nuclear weapons that they inherited at the end of the Cold War. And when the territory was not defended, number one, many Ukrainians said, well, obviously that piece of paper was worth nothing, and your promise to do it was worth nothing. Secondly, I met with several other people from other delegations that were part of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, particularly from the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, NATO members. And they were looking at our failure to live up to the Budapest Memorandum during the Obama administration. And they said, we have no sense that you will live up to Article 5 in the NATO Charter. We are NATO members, but if Russia in one way or another challenges us or actually attacks us, will you really go to war on our behalf? We're little countries on the Russian border. We don't feel that you will. That was in 2014, and so there was already that concern. So we have a mixed bag of a past.
But do you think we would have acted that way if there had been a leader in Russia who we weren't worried would actually use nuclear weapons? And I think that that's a layer of complexity.
It is.
That has been, the threat of that and the instability, the perceived instability of Putin and what he would be potentially willing to do. I think it's a very difficult situation.
I think avoiding World War III is a useful thing to avoid, and I agree.
All right, Bob, I want to give you your due, so we're going to take a break, and I'll give you the full time so when we come back, and then we welcome letters in the meantime. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll return after this break in news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. They're still going. Look at this. It's hard to get these conversations under control. Rehearsal for the next segment.
No, the mute button is the best thing in the studio besides you.
Yeah, we should probably a little bit more. Yes. I welcome you back to the program. I want to let you know who's on it. Let me reestablish and let you know who our guests are this morning. We welcome Bob Bellafiore, communications expert and founder and president of Stanhope Partners. Senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, is here. And the mayor of the city of Albany, Kathy Sheehan, joins us this morning. We have been talking about the U.S., Russia, Ukraine, and solving these issues with or without Europe or Ukraine. We heard from Kathy, we heard from Jim, and now it is time to hear from Bob.
Well, I'm going to give us a chance to hear from Jim some more because foreign policy to me is foreign by definition. But I wonder, as I've sat in governmental positions and advised people on how to find solutions, right? Nobody has a problem. No, people are very happy to lay out what's wrong with the current situation, right? But what is the solution? The American public have been very clear. They're tired of the billions we send to Ukraine. They want focus at home, not necessarily focus abroad. Foreign policy has always been transactional. As Jim brilliantly stated just before the break, the United States has a very checkered past about this. We're talking about abandoning the people of Ukraine. You mean like we abandoned Afghanistan and left our friends behind? I mean, it goes back decades. In foreign policy, the United States is about the United States. So given this stalemate, right, some of a certain age might say the magic Q word, quagmire, and everybody knows what quagmire means, unless you're under 40, which I don't think any of us here are. Mm-hmm. If you're the White House, what do you say? What is the path forward? What is the end game in Ukraine that satisfies the American public's desire to be out of this and yet manages to be true to the Ukrainians and also help create some kind of global stability? Because you're a foreign policy expert.
All right, expert. No, that's always when you drop the word expert, you always know that.
Oh no!
I know.
I'm sorry.
You're
the senior fellow at the Bard Center for Smart Things.
Right. Right. This is.
I'm just a junior fellow. What was it, trying to figure out what I'm having for lunch.
This was like when Moynihan said he was going to run against Buckley for U.S. Senate. And Buckley several times referred to him as professor.
Yes.
And Moynihan said, the mudslinging has already begun. So I get it, Bob. I get it. I see what you're doing. So you can go back and listen to the tape. On when I was on this program many times during the Biden administration, and I was always saying that I thought President Biden at the time needed to do a better job explaining to the American people what was at stake with the war in Ukraine. Number one, the current president of the United States said this was a bad war for the Ukrainians to get into. Well, guess what? They were invaded. They didn't sit around and decide to get into this war. They were actually invaded by an outside force. So that's disingenuous to hear from the president. So the current president, I think, if he really is the deal maker that he purports to be, has already played his hand. He's made it a very weak hand. I think that the only way to have a better deal at hand for the Ukrainians and for Europe and for the Americans is to put it in a better position. You know, diplomacy and the use of force go hand in glove. And so what's going on the battlefield really matters very much to what is going to be discussed around the negotiating table. And everyone who is going to be in the negotiations knows that, but then why let the hand be so weak from the Ukrainian side and from the American side? And so I think that's a major problem. You said, Bob, well, the American public has made it clear they want out of this. I don't think a lot of the American public has been really. It's been made clear to them what the stakes are. And the stakes are not just that Russia might take over a little bit more of Ukraine. That's too bad for some of the Ukrainians living there. By the way, that would be absolutely horrific for the Ukrainians who are living there. But it is also, it is the rest of Europe and the way that the rest of Europe matters to American and American security. We haven't kept NATO together for all this time. During the Cold War and after the Cold War, as an act of charity, this is something that is very much in the interests of the United States, the core security interests of the United States. I do think that American leadership of both parties have done a terrible job of articulating that to the American people. But I think that if most Americans understood that what those stakes are for them, and for this country, they would have a different outcome. There's always an isolationist wing of not just the Republican Party, but of Americans throughout American history. But whenever we've let that drive our politics, it has come back to bite us. And I fear that we're at such a moment again. And it is profoundly unfortunate.
So maybe I'm hearing this right, maybe I'm not. But I think what you're talking about is a clear, sustained message to the American people about what they have at stake. What do they have at stake?
What they have at stake? I mean, as I said, the security of Europe. So this is not just Ukraine.
Okay.
If we allow Vladimir Putin to essentially prevail here, then, and we also allow this to split the NATO alliance. This is really something that is going to put us at a high likelihood of having, number one, increased level of conflict across Europe. Actual fighting in Europe. The same what we see in Ukraine now is kind of, you know, this is old school World War II style combat. And the Baltic states would be at serious risk. Poland at serious risk. I mean, risk of conflict.
Yeah.
And I think we need to be clear about it.
Yeah, like a domino effect, say, from the 60s and 50s.
Yeah, I know.
But it's also their backyard.
Yeah.
Just as a person who's not in foreign policy, I think if Canada invaded Alaska And we fought and went to the negotiate and said, all right, you know, we need to negotiate peace. And the two people at the table negotiating what was going to happen to Alaska were Putin and the Prime Minister of Canada, right?
Or the Governor of Canada.
The Governor of Canada, right? There's just this is Europe's backyard.
Yeah,
and for them not to be at the table and for them to be ignored and for them to not have their interests at all considered in this, I think, is what a lot of Americans are reacting to. A lot of people are reacting to and saying, you know, I mean, Rubio just said that he wants to have a fair and enduring peace in Ukraine. And we've just heard from someone who knows a hell of a lot more than I do.
He's an expert.
That you don't think that Ukraine, that it will be enduring, that this will continue.
The fight will continue
okay.
on.
Okay, so another brilliant articulation of the problem. Mm-hmm. What is the path out?
Well,
tell me, right? You Stephen Covey. You begin with the end in mind. What does the solution look like? Does Russia go back to pre-conflict lines and say, "Oh no, everything's fine," right? What's the way? Because otherwise, we're stuck in this thing with no way out.
But
then we're going to have Ukrainianization.
But
and,
this is
and,
but this is an administration, and this is, you know, back to elections matter. Trump signaled that he was going to do this. He signaled that he was going to give away the land. He signaled that he was going to give Putin exactly what he wanted. And so I think it does come back to, well, elections matter. He's doing exactly what he said he was going to do. Now, you know, for those of us who say start with the end in mind, you know, first of all, you have others at the table. Like this is not just Donald Trump's deal to make with Putin. And I think that is what is very short-sighted here. And I think when you look at what this looks like to those who are literally in that backyard, it is a new world order.
But I want to answer your question.
By the way, he made it very clear, and he won an Electoral College landslide and
right.
won the popular vote for the first time as a Republican since 1988. So he said what he was going to do, and then the people voted for him.
Right, and that's why, I go back to that. So those who are upset about this on both sides need to realize elections matter. So
what are the elements of this lasting peace that's going to calm everybody down in Europe for the first time ever?
So you're asking me. So I don't think what I'm about to say that the current administration would do, because, as you said, telegraphed all along what they were going to do.
Right.
And what they're doing, let's be clear, they are selling the Ukrainians down the river. They are selling a good portion of Ukrainians who exist in what is now Russian-occupied Ukraine. I mean, this is are you aware that the Russians are taking Ukrainian children away from their parents and bringing them into Russia, that they are putting people in essentially gulags, that they, the life of Ukrainians who will be under Russian occupation will be absolutely horrific. So what would I do?
What are the elements of the lasting peace that you think would work?
So lasting peace requires that the negotiations are from a position of strength and not a position of weakness. What people apparently voted for in this electoral landslide was for the Americans to negotiate from a position of weakness. Giving up NATO membership is weak. It's bad negotiation. Giving up territorial gains before you even start negotiating is weak. It's bad negotiating. What I would do is I would say to the American people, here's why it matters, and then I would up what the Biden administration was doing. I would arm the Ukrainians more. I would give them more intelligence, and I would take the gloves off. What we have always done is said to the Ukrainians, we're going to give you this amount of arms. We want it to be as defensive as possible. The Ukrainians at one point said, you know what? The hell with that. We're going into Kursk. We're going to go into territorial Russia. We're going to bloody their nose on their own territory. I would take the gloves off. I would allow the Ukrainians to do that. I would actually allow the Ukrainians to truly, fully defend themselves. Once that happens, and once the Ukrainians start to push the Russians back, the Russians are grinding them down. They have so many more troops, and they have North Korean troops now too. Then negotiations could take place in a way that really are a negotiation, that aren't just basically selling the Ukrainians down the river. It would be a real negotiation, and we would see where it plays out. Where I suspect it would play out is that Crimea would remain Russian. Many Ukrainians who would hear me and Ukrainian Americans would be very upset at that, but that's probably where that would play out. The territory outside of the southeastern area called the Donbas would be given back to Ukraine. Some areas of southeastern Ukraine that are heavily Russian could come under international stewardship of one way or another. And that Ukrainian membership in things like NATO would remain something to be decided in the future. I suspect that's where it would end. And this would be an unhappy resolution to both sides, which is the sign of a good negotiation. That's a very different endpoint than what we are apparently going to get through what is now playing a very weak hand. So I would basically strengthen our hand, and I would strengthen the Ukrainian hand to make sure we had a really good, strong position at the table. That's my answer.
So you would escalate.
I would.
You would escalate. I
would allow the Ukrainians to escalate.
Right.
I would.
Right. And you would chop up this real estate sort of three ways: Crimea to Russia, Donbass to Ukraine, and some other part.
Donbass to international.
Donbass, the rest of Ukraine, and then the
Russians have taken other parts. They would have to get out.
They would have to get out and be under some sort of like NATO thing.
Those parts would be Ukrainian. They would be
right. But the part that's under international guidance.
Yeah.
And then you would kick the can down the road on Ukraine and NATO.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I wouldn't take it off the table, but I wouldn't operationalize it.
Okay, then how does that get resolved? Then that's a lingering. That's unsettled. That's an unsettled.
It is. That's the nature of negotiations.
Right.
Some things remain unsettled, but it's a tool to use, for us to use over the Russians, because this is also about American interests. And so we want to keep that interest. We want to keep that lever over the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
Why give it up?
Well,
it's ours.
Why would they give it up?
Because we would bloody their nose.
If they suffer enough through the escalation that you are endorsing.
Yes. Thank you. Yes.
Great. And so I'm just going to be annoying for another 30 seconds. Only that.
Kathy, feel free to save me on this.
So the funds from that comes out of the national debt. Is that come out of the money that Elon Musk is saving through?
Elon Musk isn't saving a damn thing.
Well, I know, but I'm saying
number
one. But
he's a criminal who is a highly problematic person.
So I don't even
want to bring him up.
Great.
He's an immigrant who should be expelled.
Right. So how do the American public pay for that? And then what doesn't get done? This is your Mario Cuomo thing. What doesn't get done while we do that?
Yeah. So the amount of money that we spend on Ukraine is very, very minimal compared to all the many, many other things. And it would get spent in the way that our huge Defense Department budget is always funded. So that's, you know, this kind of, you know, guns or butter argument is often the argument where people say, like, oh, you know, people assume we're spending so much more money. Even, you know, if you look on the foreign assistance, the University of Maryland does a poll every year. People are asked, how much do we think we spend on foreign assistance?
Oh, yeah.
They say like 25%, less than 1%.
Right.
This is not a question of money. And the programs that are not being funded here in the United States are not because of Ukraine. I mean, I really think that is not the answer to it. And it's a political will question. Do people have the political will to sustain the Ukrainians in this fight? And it's not a question of do we have the money to do it. We do have the money to do it. And we could lean on the Europeans more, as we should, to do more.
And that's,
and I think
that,
we should.
They should cover some of their own.
Well, look, no, I think
it's not just J.D. Vance. Obama also said that to the Europeans.
Yes. And I think
but
the
J.D.
Europeans
Vance is the one getting killed for it.
But the Europeans need. I don't think anybody's killing. I mean, I agree that the Europeans need to spend more. But I think the important point there is the Europeans need to be at the table as this is playing out. You talk about how do you get there? We bring partners to the table and we listen to them. And we respect them, and we do demand more of them. But they need to be part of the solution because that's the only way that the NATO piece
including
is really
the escalation solution. I mean, the Brits have already 100%. Said they would step up, and others have said too, and I think we need to take them at their word.
All right, let's go to some letters here, and we'll let the dust settle just a little bit, and although maybe the letters will fire it up again.
Get it dustier. Get it dustier.
Bob says, if the European nations are at the table from day one, there is no likelihood that there will be any agreement. Just look at the turmoil in the EU. Having Russia and the U.S. come up with a proposed agreement for Europe to respond to will unite those countries probably in opposition to come up with its own peace proposal. That from Bob. Then we go to Rachel. Dear panel, can you not echo right-wing talking points with no evidentiary support? Kathy, stop doing that. Trump won the election, but calling it an electoral landslide is not accurate. He won a plurality, not a majority of the popular vote, and he won what was not an historic win in the Electoral College. Then we go to Corey. While discussing the Ukraine war and Trump, the U.S. people voted first on improving their lives through lower prices for food, housing, etc., not Trump's foreign policy on Ukraine. Then we go to this, again, another one. Please stop indulging Trump. It was not a landslide. Reagan in 84. Now that was a landslide. Then we go to Raymond, who says, you guys are right about Ukraine. It was bad for Trump to deal with Russia and not Ukraine in Europe. A thought occurred to me. Isn't that how the U.S. has dealt with Palestine for decades? We talk to Israel and then make announcements of policies that affect Palestinians, but don't talk to Palestinians.
I think we've all agreed that the U.S. has a checkered past on foreign policy. Yeah.
Then we check in with Dave. What the hell is going wrong with the Republican Party in the last decade? Remember when the Republican Party was the party of national security and quite hawkish? Now, like your guest keeps arguing, at least the subtext of what he's saying, they can't surrender to dictators fast enough. When did appeasing dictators become the highest ideal of the Republican Party?
And let me just point out, not just any dictator, a Russian dictator.
Now we go to Mike, who says, much of what Trump has done so far is retribution for perceived wrongs. This includes Zelensky. Trump is trying to punish Zelensky for when Zelensky refused to provide dirt on Hunter and Joe Biden in exchange for releasing congressionally appropriated funds for Ukraine. This led to his first impeachment. He hasn't forgiven him. He is extremely vindictive. He blames Zelensky for the impeachment, not himself. Why don't people see this?
I think that's a point well taken. The people forget about that, have forgotten about that issue and Vindman, who then went up the chain of command as he should have done to report this conversation that he heard. Between Trump and Zelensky, and I think that Donald Trump is no fan of Zelensky and is, in fact, I think that's a part of this equation. I don't think it's everything, but it is a part of the equation.
We just have less than a minute, but Irene says, I appreciate Jim's comments about Ukraine. Here's an American saying we are betraying Ukraine and Europe by not including them in talks that are including Russia. Trump is what Putin wished for. Then we get this letter from Gabor, who says, correct. Yes, correct that it's not just Ukraine, but it's not just Europe either. For most of human history, conquest was the norm. After the horror of World War II, a prohibition of the use of force became a critical component of the UN Charter, heralding in a new era of the rule of law in international relations. Without this prohibition, there is no right of peoples to self-determination, no guarantee of human rights, and no accountability for mass atrocities. Russia, Ukraine, Israel in the occupied territories, China's threats against Taiwan, Trump's refusal to rule of force against Denmark, Canada, Panama all suggest that the brief experiment in civilization may be over. We'll pause on that happy note and think we'll try to cheer ourselves up over a break. When we come back, we'll continue and finish up the program. We welcome your input, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We would love to hear from you. Panel at WAMC.org, and we will continue our conversation on the roundtable after this break in news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday morning. It is the 18th of February, and we have a few minutes with our terrific group, and we'll make the most of it and try to get to as many topics as we possibly can in the time allowed. I want to talk about, again, there is so much going on, and you try to figure it, you know, make the most of it here. So I want to talk about the IRS and the story having to do with the kerfuffle over the it seems maybe worse than a kerfuffle, right? Let me just bring this up. This is taking longer than I had wanted it to. Top Social Security official exits after clash with Musk's Doge over data. Yet another top career staffer is leaving the administration amid a disagreement over a request by Elon Musk's team for sensitive government information. The acting commissioner of the Social Security Administration left her job this weekend after a clash with Elon Musk's Doge service over its attempts to access sensitive government records. Three people familiar with her departure said Monday. Michelle King, who spent several decades at the agency before being named its acting commissioner last month, left her position Sunday after the disagreement, according to those in the department. The president appointed Leland Dudick, a manager in charge of Social Security's anti-fraud office's acting commissioner, while Frank Bisignano, I'm probably saying that wrong.
Bisignano.
Thank you.
Donahue.
Okay. Thank you, Bob. The president's nominee for permanent commissioner is vetted by the Senate, according to three individuals who spoke on the condition of anonymity to talk candidly. So that going on in the Social Security office. Meanwhile, taxpayer groups and unions are filing suit over what is happening at the IRS. The plaintiffs expressed concerns about letting U.S. Doge service, led by Elon Musk, see sensitive information such as net worth and income. So the taxpayer groups and unions are now suing Doge over that activity. And let me see. There was one more thing I wanted to bring up. Donald Trump is scheduled to sign executive orders today at Mar-a-Lago. Later, Fox News plans to air a joint interview with Trump and advisor Elon Musk conducted by Sean Hannity. Meanwhile, Trump's top foreign policy advisors are in Saudi Arabia on Tuesday for talks with Russian counterparts about ending the war in Ukraine. So all of that going on as well. But Doge, who would like to go?
Well, for me, the burning question is, are we finally going to get to see Donald Trump's tax returns?
No, I know.
It's a funny question because a contractor to the IRS already stole them and leaked them, along with the tax returns of hundreds of other people. So you're good.
Jim?
I'm going to defer to Bob on this. He's the expert.
I know what that means. Thank you very much. I love to be called an expert. What do I think? I think people love to hate Elon Musk because he sounds like a James Bond villain.
Isn't he a James Bond villain?
I think if his name was Joe Donahue, people wouldn't have as many issues with him. That's just atmospherics.
Okay.
These are hard to see. Like, I have been in government after a hostile takeover. Right. When I worked for George Pataki, it was after 20 years of Democratic governors. Nobody thought Mario Cuomo would lose. The government was very entrenched in his way, and Governor Pataki came in with a totally different way of thinking about things. And I had many, many serious conversations with people about what we were trying to do and the difficulty in changing a large bureaucratic mindset. Now, the size of New York State's bureaucracy is like a hair on a pinky toe compared to the size of the federal bureaucracy. So I can imagine how much more difficult and involved the challenge is, right? So this is just a description of the environment, right? You have people who have been in places for a long time. I remember having, conversations with the press about us forcing out career government officials. Well, yeah, they had been there for 20 years, and they had a completely different way of thinking than the governor did, right? Their philosophy was not aligned, right? You get tension, and then you get heaps and heaps of awful press about the process of trying to take control of the vast bureaucracy.
But in most cases,
the president's allowed to do.
But in most cases, most of these employees are newer employees who are incoming, and they have not yet touched those regions of government workers who have been there for decades.
Well, let's see. He's been in office almost a month. And it takes some time to do that. All I'm saying is this kind of tension would be natural. Now, I don't know if what I can't say, and I don't think anybody can say, other than by speculating, whether what Doge is doing and what the White House is starting is done with good intention or bad intention. That will all be colored by what you think about the guy, which everybody has an opinion of. So I guess my bottom line is this tension is to be expected when a new way of thinking comes in and combats an old way of thinking. To take the outrage with a bit of a grain of salt, because nobody is uninvested in this one way or another.
But I think, can I just say, you talked about the illegal dissemination of tax returns. That was illegal. And I think what is giving people pause is that these are people who are coming in. They are downloading databases based on the reporting that we're seeing. They're getting access to sensitive information. And what they do with it is under the auspices of Doge and this president, perfectly legal. And I think that is what people are, or at least they're using the color of law, right, to say this is all perfectly legal and we're just accessing this information because we want to make government more efficient. And the distrust that exists on all sides, I think, is what is also feeding this. So
sure,
that level of checks and balances we aren't seeing, thus we're seeing all these lawsuits.
And I think we need to be careful about saying, what the president is allowed to do. So, for instance, with USAID, was created by JFK by executive order, but in the late 90s, during the Clinton administration, and a deal between Clinton and Jesse Helms was enshrined in statute. So the president is not allowed to undo USAID entirely as a federal agency. They have to go through Congress to do this. That's what they're allowed to do. They're allowed to negotiate with Congress on it. Also, it's just terrible administrative procedure to say, well, in order to fix some bureaucratic issues in an agency, we're going to undo the entire agency. That's just absolutely nonsensical. And the result I think weakens America's position in the world and opens it to our adversaries. I know we're not talking about USAID at this moment, but it also the way that it affects actual people. You know, when you have the president saying they're radical lunatics, or you have Musk saying that these are you know, people who are corrupt and they're engaged in propaganda. I'll just give you one example of. I mean, I know several people have been affected by this and are now out of work. One of them is a former naval aviator, and maybe one of the only people I know who was is a Navy veteran and also is a returned Peace Corps volunteer. Was working for USAID in the wake of 9/11. Was in Afghanistan on something that we developed, these things called provincial reconstruction teams, where you had development, diplomacy, and defense all together. You had the military, you had the State Department, you had USAID on the side of mountains in the middle of nowhere. And so if you want to reform his agency, fine. But you want to call him the president of the United States, calling him a radical lunatic, an unpatriotic American? That's outrageous. That's outrageous.
Did he say that about him, or did he just paint a broad brush?
He said about everybody who works for USAID. Oh, yeah. So he's the president.
That's stupid.
It's stupid, and it's dangerous, and it's unacceptable. And do you think all those people who voted for Donald Trump really voted for that? They voted to call people like the one I just described a radical lunatic and an unpatriotic American?
I would say probably not.
I think maybe they did. Unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well.
But who? I mean, how long is this? We're still under the question of what Musk's role is, what his title is, what his security clearance is. I mean, apparently none. And of what he, by the president, is given just incredible latitude to pretty much do. Whatever he wants, and I think that's what strikes so many people as odd, and not only odd, but as this goes through the courts as illegal, and where is that going to end up? I don't get that part.
I mean, I think we're still talking about this particular government as if it's a representative democracy. And I don't, based on what I'm seeing, this is about self-interest. It's about money. It's about, you know, making sure that the interests of a very small number of very wealthy people are seen to. And I think a lot of times there are those in this country who think, well, if they take care of them, then they're going to be taking care of me, right? Because if these corporations are strong, then I'll be okay. But, you know, we have a person as president who throughout his career made a lot of money by entering into deals, making promises in those deals, then breaking those promises, either not paying or not paying as much, getting sued. And when he really got in hot water, he would declare bankruptcy and, you know, everybody would get cents on the dollar. Like that was the cycle of how he built up his business and did deals. And I think to expect anything different in how he's approaching the, you know, Trump presidency 2.0, people just, if they're surprised by it, I think they just weren't paying attention. So you look at, in the city of Albany right now, we have 150 people who stood in line. They lived in refugee camps, in war-torn countries, all around the world. And they got in line, and they waited, and they went through background checks, and they did everything that they were supposed to do. And they got a plane ticket, and they came over here on a promise that for 90 days, we'd help them. 90 days. Not a lot of time to get on your feet when you don't speak English as a first language. You may not even read your own language, right? Might not even be literate in your own language. But for 90 days, we'll help you get a roof over your head. If you need medical care, you'll get medical care. And we're going to help you find a job, right? That was the promise. And when the president was sworn in, it was, I believe, the very next day, if not certainly the next week, that all of the agencies that were tasked with helping refugees for those first 90 days were told, you cannot spend a single penny. Now, I get telling the person with the plane ticket who hasn't gotten on the plane yet, don't get on the plane, right? I get that. That's the president's prerogative. But to the people who were here, based on a promise that for 90 days we would help you, to be told, sorry, our doors are locked, we've had to fire our entire staff, and we can't help you. That, to me, again, doesn't surprise me, but that is what this administration's approach is. And if they're going to break that promise, what's the next promise? You were counting on that child tax credit? This president thinks that he can just decide not to pay it to you. Medicaid finally approved your hip replacement. That is the paradigm that we are dealing with right now. It doesn't surprise me. It appalls me. But the broken promises and the brashness with which we just don't have to follow what Congress told us, that is what we're dealing with. And I think that's why people are having such a hard time reacting to it.
And Kathy, can I ask, because in addition to being the mayor of our city, you're also a lawyer. So what happens when the administration has been told by federal courts in some cases that the money can't be stopped, that it needs to be restarted and start flowing, and they don't follow those court orders? What happens next?
And we only have just a few seconds.
Yeah, good luck.
I think that is a huge question mark that's out there, and it will be brand new territory, and we're going to have to navigate it.
Mayor
Sheehan, like student loan forgiveness.
Jim Ketterer and Bob Bellafiore, thank you all for being with us. A great pleasure to have you all on the program. Quite a run. Good. We'll be back right after this.